It is September 5th, 2025, and tensions continue to soar between the US and Russia as we see Trump getting on social media today complaining that the US has lost Russia and India to deepest, darkest China, he says, as if the US had no role in creating divisions that are helping the pillars of the multipolar world do more and more to work together. But as all of this is happening, you also have the U.S. continuing to carry out military exercises near Russia. You have the Trump administration signing off on more long-range cruise missiles for Ukraine. You have the U.S. directly involved in this proxy war against Russia. And the question remains, just how involved are they going to get? Well, we got into that and much more with a special guest earlier. So let's take a listen to that conversation now. Joining me now to discuss is retired U.S. Army Colonel Douglas McGregor, a defense and foreign policy analyst and former Pentagon advisor. Colonel McGregor, thanks so much for taking the time to join me.
Sure, happy to be here.
Now, before we get into talking about the latest news, I do want to mention this new event series that you're working on called The National Conversation. And this is really cool because not only do people get a chance to come and see you in person and listen to you speak, but they also get a chance to talk back, to get the microphone themselves, to ask you and other expert panelists direct questions without all of the policing of big tech that we unfortunately have to deal with, even with conversations like the one that we're having right now. So will you start out by kind of telling us about how the idea came about for the National Conversation and what your vision is for this upcoming event, what people can expect?
Well, listen, this is an important question. I'm glad you asked it. The National Conversation came along at a point in time where lots and lots of people had approached me and my coworkers and said, we're not happy with the alternatives presented to us by the Republicans and the Democrats. It's back to this argument. You go out, you vote for President Trump or anybody else, and you get John McCain. And we're a little tired of this. So they said, what are you going to do? Is there some other way forward? And I think the National Conversation, if we're successful, is designed to do two things. First of all, we're not out there to lecture everybody on what they ought to think. The panel that we've developed with Natalie Brunell and Andrew Napolitano, people that everybody knows, and myself, is really designed to answer questions that the moderator, Olga Rivazzi, is going to frame for us. They'll be about finance, you know, should you end the Fed? How do you fix the debt? These kinds of things. And then also, what do we do to get out of the current confrontation with Russia and Eastern Europe? How do we end, you know, our involvement in these overseas conflicts? These things will come up. We'll provide answers, but then we're going to turn to the audience and say, what do you think? We want the audience to stand up and tell us what they think. Now, why would we want to do that? Because I don't think you can form a third movement, a third way, or a third party, unless it's bottom up. What's not going to work is a billionaire who stands up and says, I have the answers. I'm founding this party because I've got plenty of money and I can do that. And this is why you should vote for me. It's not enough. We've got to get the American people involved. We're going to see if it works because we really want to know what they think. What are their interests? What's the most important thing? As one person already said to me, let me give you three answers. Inflation, inflation, inflation. I said, okay, that's an answer. It's a legitimate one. And the thing that we're arguing and have argued from the very beginning, and this is what the National Conversation wants to address, is no president, no government right now can do everything. So we have to be selective. We have to decide what is most important to the American people. That's what we've got to do first and foremost. And I don't think anybody else is asking that question. So that's where we want to start. What's most important? What is the one thing we must do immediately for this country? And then that's the sort of point of departure, if you will. So it's on the 4th of October in Dallas, Texas, in the Frontiers of Flight Museum, which is a spectacular museum. If you've never been to it, it's worth the trip just to see it. And we'll see how it goes. It's an experiment. If it's successful, well, then we'll go to other locations in the United States. We'll raise the same kinds of questions to get the same kinds of answers. And I don't think things are going to improve dramatically in America right now. So I think there's an appetite for this. So it's just a question of where and when and how we do it. we're going to start in Dallas and see where we go from there.
Yeah, and I think that this is a great series that you're putting together and a good time to have this conversation, because I know that a lot of Americans are looking around, and it was all too easy when you were in 2024 to say, okay, we've had a Democrat in office, now let's put a Republican in office, now let's, you know, kind of turn to the other side. But we keep doing that with this swinging pendulum where we have all of these hopes for the next guy who comes into office, and then they come in, and now we're at this place where already we're, you know, a little over 7 months into Trump's second term, and we're looking around going, wait a second, he campaigned on all of these things and he's not doing all of these things. And I know that there really is an appetite, like you were saying, for answers, right? People want solutions. So when it comes to furthering that conversation and the kind of topics that you're going to be covering, how are you viewing that? I'm sure there's going to be a little bit of foreign policy and some immigration in there, but how just wide ranging do you expect it to be?
Well, we've talked about it. We think we absolutely have to address the national sovereign debt and the growing financial crisis. It's unavoidable. We have to talk about cutting spending, which is, you know, about as popular as contracting cancer inside the Beltway. The words cut are just non-existent. Nobody ever brings it up, but we're going to be forced into that. And of course, that really drives everything else. If you are up against the wall financially, you can't manage these overseas interventions and meddling that we've been engaged in. You can't maintain our commitments all over the world. There has to be some recognition that we need restraint. We need to exercise restraint strategically. So I think that's where it starts. And then it brings you into things like healthcare. We spend more money on healthcare than any other country in the world. We seem to have a pretty unsatisfactory outcome. A lot of people are unhappy with the healthcare system because it's not turning out to work for them very well. So, you know, all of these things are interconnected. You're not going to say, well, I'm going to talk about foreign policy, I'm going to talk about defense, I'm going to talk about finance, and that's it. Because you're going to move through these questions and touch on the things that affect people's lives. And, you know, the issue with immigration is it affects people's lives. You know, if you look at the job numbers, jobs for illegals, for people that have entered this country illegally, are way up, and they are drawing sustenance, great amounts of money. Well, what about the people that are American citizens? Where do they fall in? And their jobs are evaporating, drying up. So all of this has to be discussed. Now, will we get to everything in 2 hours? Probably not. But I think it's a beginning, and I think it has to happen. And we got to give the mic to somebody in the audience and say, okay, now is your shot. What do you think? I hope they'll stand up and tell us what they think.
Yeah, well, I'm sure they will. And I think you're going to get a good reception, especially from people. And we see it, you know, even in just in the comments section, the people that watch what you have to say. They like what you have to say and they want to get a chance to respond. Well, now they're getting that chance. And I'll be sure to leave all of the links below so that people can check out how to buy tickets and get more information if they're interested. Now, while I have you here, I do want to get into some of the latest news when it comes to U.S. foreign policy, because of course, we're looking at the Trump administration right now. We have them signing off on more long-range cruise missiles for Ukraine, but that's not all they're doing. I know there are also reports of the U.S. carrying out provocative flights and really NATO activity near Russia's Kola Peninsula, even involving B-2 bombers. So can you take us through kind of what we're seeing and what the American people should know about it?
Well, the American people are unaware that at least in the air, we have flown a lot of aircraft, normally for reconnaissance purposes, intelligence collection purposes, all up and down the front from the Kola Peninsula in northern Finland all the way down to the Black Sea, with the goal, obviously, of finding out what the Russians are up to, how many aircraft they have in the air, how many troops are on the ground, where they're massing, where they're not. But lately, what we've seen is the introduction of B-2 bombers into this mix, which is very provocative, especially if you go back and remember that when President Trump met with President Putin, as they were walking to greet each other and then go into the building for discussions, you had these F-22s on either side. And then you had the B-2 overflying, the airport or the airbase, Elmendorf. Now, I'm sure President Trump was trying to signal strength by this display and show everybody how much we've got and what we can do. But I'm a little concerned that President Trump has drunk the proverbial Kool-Aid on the Air Force. The Air Force has a long history of essentially stepping up and saying they can do everything, whatever the mission is, with enough bombs and enough time, they can turn everything around. It's gotten us into a lot of trouble. In 1942, when General Arnold, who was at the time was a three-star, arrived in England, he was asked, what are you going to do? And he said, well, if we do what we're supposed to do and what we know we can do, there'll never be a requirement for a single U.S. soldier to step onto the continent of Europe. We can win this war entirely with air power. We know how that worked out. It didn't work. And we went through something similar in Vietnam. We had this thing called Rolling Thunder. And this was an air assault, an air offensive that was designed to pound North Vietnam into submission. That didn't work. And as you go forward, you go all the way to Desert Storm in 1990-91. We had this 40-day air campaign, which was designed to beat Iraq into submission, but nobody withdrew. There was no submission. There was no capitulation. Ultimately, you had a ground force that had to go in there, and eventually that ended the war. I think we're beginning to see evidence for more of this. This man that was appointed as chairman of the Joint Chiefs is an Air Force officer, and Trump liked him because he was an advocate for bombing everything in sight in the Middle East against ISIS. He credits him with having won the war against ISIS, which is a little hard to make that case, given the fact that the ISIS commander is now running Syria. But that's another story. But having said that, I think Hegseth, of course, is signed on for this kind of thing. And in their minds, I think they truly believe that they are bullying Moscow, that they're intimidating Moscow. Moscow is not intimidated, but Moscow is beginning to lose patience. And that's dangerous. And we should not behave as though we are invincible, invulnerable, invisible. We're not. And I'm very worried about these provocative measures right now. And this is just within the last 24 hours. You can find this material online. This is open source. It's just that people don't usually put it together. But all of the comments, the threats that are either implied or stated publicly by President Trump or Secretary of State Rubio, or more important, the Secretary of Defense Hegseth, all fall into this pattern. And then we have the usual retired generals like Keane coming on television, trying to convince everybody one more time that Russia is weak and Russia can be bullied and Russia is falling apart. None of that has been true. It's always been false. And I see it being sort of repackaged in a new narrative that says, We can win this for the Ukrainians. You know, we can throw the Russians out. No, we can't. And more important, we don't want to. We don't want to be involved in this at all. There's nothing in it for us. But that never comes up for decision or for discussion. So I think it's a very dangerous moment. Americans should pay more attention to what's happening. But I know they have a lot on their plates and they're worried about putting food on the table and a declining economy. We're sliding into what some people think is stagflation now. Back to the Carter years. I hope not. And then we have the $9 trillion debt payment coming due at the end of the year. No one's figured out how we're going to pay $9 trillion to our creditors. I don't know. The bottom line is that all of this has to be viewed together at once, which is difficult. We need the whole picture. And the picture right now with Russia is dangerous. And we haven't even talked about the Middle East, where we are shipping technology, missiles, equipment, assistance, as fast as we can to Israel for what looks like a resumption of the war in the Middle East. So to go back to what we were talking about earlier, we thought we were voting for fundamental change in a new positive direction. It doesn't seem as though we're on that track at all. It seems as though we're getting more of the same and maybe worse.
Yeah, wow. And in just a matter of months, and as you're laying it out there, I'm sitting here and I'm thinking about the fact that obviously, yes, Trump ran on this anti-war platform. That's what a number of presidential candidates do because it works every time. That's what the American people want to hear. But now we have Trump getting ready to, he's expected to today, sign off on an executive order to rename the Department of Defense to the Department of War. And everything that you're discussing there looks like we're gearing up for more and more war. That's incredibly concerning, especially when you take into account the fact that the U.S. does not seem remotely ready for all of this war. I mean, I know when we look at the talks that were had between Trump and Putin, Trump went into it acting like he was going to get a full ceasefire. Clearly, Putin sat there and told him all of the ways and the reasons why that wasn't going to happen. But how do you view this position that the U.S. is in and kind of how much longer we can carry on with this trajectory, especially as the last thing that I'll add there is that you have Putin bringing up the fact this week that the Ukrainian military is in critical condition, that they're no longer capable of large-scale operations. And doesn't exactly seem like the U.S. is in a position to jump in and to, quote unquote, save everyone or fight all of these different wars. But that still seems to be the direction that we're headed.
No, I think that's true. I don't have a good answer in terms of understanding why Trump has done the about face that apparently is the case. He is in a position to end the conflict in Ukraine. He's always been in a position to do that. But I think he doesn't want to simply tell the truth. This war is lost. It was never necessary. It could have been avoided. I didn't want it. And so I am making the decision to end any further assistance to the Ukrainian regime and then talk truthfully about the regime in Kiev. This is not the Hardy Boys on an adventure in Kiev. This is an organized crime state in the most sincere sense of the word. No one stands up and talks about the trafficking of women and children out of Ukraine. No one talks about the massive drugs that flow out of Ukraine. All of this needs to be presented, but for some reason, I assume it's because of the people around President Trump. They haven't bothered to tell him, or they've told him it's perhaps antithetical to his political interests to tell the truth. I don't know. But it needs to be told, and we need to make it abundantly clear that we never had any vital strategic interest in eastern Ukraine, or in Ukraine for that matter at all. And then end this notion of continual expansion, NATO on the grounds that somehow or another we're pushing everyone in the direction of liberal democracy. That's absurd. There's no evidence for that at all. Europe is also falling apart. I mean, if you go to Germany and you look at these seven unexplained deaths of alternative for Germany politicians. I mean, statistically, the idea that all these people could die suddenly before an election seems absurd. So what is really happening? And quite frankly, right now, the globalists that rule Western Europe in particular, Paris, London, Berlin, all take the same position. If you do not support their policies, whether it's open borders, unrestricted immigration, anything that they put forward, then you're a radical extremist and your free speech is eliminated. In other words, we'll tolerate free speech as long as it agrees with us. I think Europe is moving to the boiling point. But in the meantime, the question we need to ask is, why are we supporting any of it? Why would we want to be part of it? And I know President Trump, and I know that his view has always been the Europeans need to be their own first responders militarily. And so I don't know what's going on with him, except that perhaps he thinks he's cut some good deal for us because we're shipping missiles over the next year or two to them that they can resell to Ukraine. I don't see how that works for us long term. It's certainly not going to improve our relationship with Russia. And I think we have a long term strategic interest in good relations with Russia. But this cabal around Trump has decided no. And he appears to have capitulated to them, just as he's capitulated to the forces that seem to be dedicated to the destruction of Iran and the balkanization of the Middle East as a way to make Israel great again and safe again.
Yeah, it's incredibly concerning to watch. And I know that Trump has been paying particular attention to the gathering that we saw in China this week, where we've seen a lot of talk from him on social media complaining about the leaders of Russia and India and China getting together. And he doesn't seem to understand that part of the reason why they're all warming up to each other is because they're looking at the U.S. and they're going, we don't feel like we can trust the U.S. We feel like the U.S. is, you know, waging all of these different wars. And so naturally, you're going to have China and India start to say, okay, where can we mend ties and normalize relations? Now, as all of that is happening, I do want to get into the Middle East a little bit while I have you here, because I know that you were mentioning the position that the U.S. is in, where it seems like it's ramping or getting ready to ramp up tensions, specifically targeting Iran. What are your concerns when it comes to the Middle East, and really what the U.S. did not learn from the last go around when we had the 12-day war just a couple of months ago?
You know, we all know that President Trump is sitting in the White House in no small measure because of the enormous donations to his campaign that came from people like Adelson and others, Singer, many very, very wealthy figures who are devoted to the state of Israel. In many cases, these people are dual citizens. Right now, there are dual citizens all over the White House, dual citizens all over the Hill in Congress, Israel and the United States. This is a very, very dangerous set of circumstances, in my judgment. You can't serve two masters. You can only serve one. America first means that you are first, last, and always an American, and that you owe allegiance to no earthly power other than your own country. That's not the case right now. And we seem to be in harness, moving in directions that the Israeli state, its supporters, and the banks in London and New York City and in Washington want us to move. Now, is this dangerous? Yes, I think it's dangerous. They've taken the position that the Arab states are weak and incapable. And by the way, many of the governments in the Arab states are effectively Washington's puppets. And so why worry about what happens to the Arabs? Treat them as expendable. I think that's very dangerous, because just because they appear to be weak at this point because of governments over them that support whatever we in Israel want them to do, doesn't mean the populations do. And if you look at the attitudes that we are aware of in the populations in the Emirates and the Saudi Peninsula, most of the Arab world, they are all extremely negative towards us in Israel. We should not exclude the possibility that these governments suddenly go under. And then you're dealing with someone who's entirely hostile to you because you've effectively supported and sponsored their oppressive governments for years. This is not a new pattern. We've been through this before in Latin America and Africa and other places. Right now, we're losing our footing in Africa for similar reasons. We backed the wrong horses for the wrong reasons. So we're being driven out. And everybody is saying, oh, well, the Russians are moving in and the Chinese are moving in. They don't have to try very hard, because what we've left in the wake of our positions there is ruinous. The whole world, I think, is now being forced into a decision. You have the United States heavily in debt with the dollar that is now regarded as a menace, as poison. Because if you do business in dollars and you take dollars, you're absorbing the debt. You're becoming part of the problem. You're becoming a debt slave too. They don't want to do that. So whether you're in West Africa or Northeast Asia, people are saying, look, we don't want any part of this anymore. Secondly, we've used the dollar-based system through the IMF, the World Bank, SWIFT, everything, as a means of bullying people into doing what we want. We've even dictated to countries around the world what crops they will grow. I mean, stop and consider this. This sort of thing has reached the boiling point. And India in particular, I think, was shocked at the way Trump responded to President Modi. India may not be a bosom friend of the United States, but it's not the enemy. And the first law of international relations is you want to practice economy of enemies. Don't make any enemies that you don't have to have. I mean, to be frank with you, if you go back and look at the ultimate imperialist of all time, the British Empire, they were very good at this. They would sort through who out there would work with them and who would not. And then they isolated the person that was really, or the entity that was really opposed to them, and brought everybody else on side. I mean, how do such a small minority of people rule a quarter of the world's landmass? Come on, there's a reason for it. We've been very stupid ever since Bush was first in power. Either you're with us or you're against us. Well, that's a very stupid position to take. So why not narrow your focus to the particular individual that you're opposed to and then bring everybody else on side against it. We're not doing that. Boeing just lost $35 billion in airplane contracts because India canceled them. Now, President Trump, you know, postures as the workers' protector and the workers' friend. Well, the workers at Boeing, and there are over 100,000 of them, are now looking at a tremendous loss in revenue and income. And selling Boeing aircraft to India is not something that's going to put our national security at risk. That's ridiculous. So what you're seeing is this new system emerge. The new system is going to be a basket of currencies, all of which are probably gold-backed or gold and other commodities backing it. In other words, they're moving away from our fiat currency system. And remember, our fiat currency is based on trust. Your dollar is worth something, not because it's backed by anything tangible, but because we trust the government. So the dollars ought to be changed right now from "In God We Trust." It should say "In the government we trust," because that's all we've got right now. And I don't think the rest of the world is going to buy into that anymore. So you've got one new financial system emerging, building parallel institutions just like ours, only these are new and more modern and more effective and more efficient, frankly. That's going to move a large part of the world. How much of it? I would say at least half of it. Most of the Eastern Hemisphere is going to move in that direction, with the exception, of course, of some of the European states. And that leaves some of the Europeans and us in what we've got now. The question is, what are we going to do with it? It's back to where we were in finance. If you've got a $9 trillion bill come due at the end of this year that's designed to offset the, you know, your debt payments or meet your debt payments, and you can't do it, what does that do to our financial system? How is the bond market going to weather things? If you go to look at Great Britain right now, what's happening in Britain is almost a microcosm of what lies in store for us down the line. Their gilt market, which is the equivalent of our bond market, is spiking. They can't possibly pay these things. And they're not the only ones. Everybody in Europe is in the same boat with us. When I say Europe, I'm talking about primarily Western Europe. Two systems are diverging. One is the old system, which is going to have to change or alter in order to be remotely effective. What is that going to be? Is it going to be digital currency? I have no idea where we're headed. I haven't heard anything from Bessent or anybody else that makes any sense right now. And then you have this new system that's emerging that is actually going to be backed by something and be real. So the two are irreconcilable, so you'll have two systems. Now, the danger here is when you split economically like that, it can set the stage for military conflict. That's the bad news. That's the last thing we want. And I don't think that's something President Trump wants. But the bottom line is that what he's doing right now is very provocative towards Russia, towards Iran. And even though he seems to talk more reasonably about China, China cannot be separated any longer from what happens in Iran or what happens in Russia. Neither can India. This doesn't mean that everyone there is gearing up for war against us. It's a simple statement of fact. The new system, its adherents, BRICS, everything together, is going to stand in opposition to us and what we want to do in their part of the world. We have to abandon the pursuit of global military hegemony. It's bankrupting and it doesn't work. And it's not necessary. But that's where I part from all the people that you're listening to on the Fox News and everywhere else who say, no, 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 we must have that. There will be no security unless we are the global military hegemon. And so that results in these outrageous bills for defense. And most of that is not necessary because we don't have to be everywhere all the time. And right now, that's where we are. And we're not postured to fight. We're not ready for it. We can't afford it.
Yeah, that's the crazy part when you look at what the U.S. is doing, is that it is making all of these moves, yet it's not remotely prepared for it. And I think exactly as you were pointing out there, the U.S. is in this position where everything is connected. And that's something that is good for people to keep in mind. I'll remind them that we've got the inaugural edition of the National Conversation coming up in Dallas on October 4th. And I'll be sure to leave all of the links below so that people can check out more information and see where they can see you in person. But as always, I really appreciate you taking the time to join me today to break down all of the latest here. Retired U.S. Army Colonel Douglas McGregor, a defense and foreign policy analyst and former Pentagon advisor, thank you so much for your time and insight.
Sure. Thank you, Rachel. Appreciate it.
If anything in this video resonated with you, be sure to like it, share it with your friends, leave a comment. And as always, don't forget to subscribe. And if you want to keep up with all of my work, make sure that you're subscribed to my page on Substack. That's rachelblevins.substack.com. That's where you'll find ad-free videos and new weekly episodes of my exclusive series for paid subscribers called Sanctioned. You can also check out Sanctioned over on my page on Patreon. That's patreon.com/Rachel Blevins. As always, thank you all so much for all of your support, and I'll see you next time.